Last month, many people around the world were stunned at the arrest of Andrew Mountbatten Windsor on charges of misconduct in office because of his ties to Jeffrey Epstein. Now, Mountbatten Windsor, of course, had until last fall been known as Prince Andrew, His Royal Highness, Duke of York. He had stood eighth in line to the British throne, which is currently occupied by his brother, King Charles III. Andrew is actually the highest senior royal official to face arrest in the UK since King Charles I in 1647, who also was arrested, eventually beheaded as part of the English Civil War. There have been a few others who have faced charges on the Epstein related to the Epstein case, and many others who've been forced to resign or fired across Europe, the UK, Norway, France, Slovakia. Here in the US, we haven't seen anybody else officially charged, but there have been business leaders, Ivy League professors that have been forced to resign or been fired from their positions. It is an all too familiar story. A powerful figure ends up disgraced and powerless, brought down by the very forces that he, and it usually is a he, has depended on for maintaining power for so long. We saw it again this week. The disturbing news about sexual assaults committed by Cesar Chavez. Even though he's been dead for more than 30 years, we've seen a rapid fall from grace for him, as state and local governments quickly are removing his name from celebrations, recognizing the important work of the United Farm Workers. There are plenty of other traps that powerful figures fall into besides sexual misconduct. I mean, we've seen it with Gregory Bovino, the former head of the Border Patrol, lost his title of commander at large following the killing of several protesters in Minneapolis. His boss, DHS Secretary Kristi Noem, reassigned after approving a $220 million advertising campaign in which she is prominently featured. This story of those in power striving to hold on to power. It's a tale as fresh as our morning headlines and as old as probably human civilization itself. And we see it on display in our text for this morning as well. Pontius Pilate is in the midst of his own struggle to maintain power here. This passage for today follows directly on the heels of last week's text when Jesus is first brought to Pilate. And throughout these two chapters, Pilate is repeatedly looking for ways to release Jesus. Three times he says, "I find no grounds for any charge against him." He begins this process already at the end of last week's reading when he offers to release Jesus as an act of Passover mercy, but the crowds clamor for Barabbas instead. And so as today's text opens, he has Jesus beaten, and he brings him out to the crowd, presumably hoping they'll be satisfied by his brutalized appearance. But the sight of a bloodied and bruised Jesus wearing a purple robe and a crown of thorns only seems to whet the appetite for this bloodthirsty crowd. When Pilate says there's no case against him, the religious authorities shout to have Jesus crucified. And when Pilate suggests these Jewish leaders do it themselves, they point out that this is Pilate's job. That Jesus has actually claimed to be God's son. Now that's a charge from their standpoint, a charge of blasphemy, which is worthy of death. But it also has political implications because Son of God was one of many titles that Caesar claimed for himself. Well, wisely refusing to just accept this hearsay evidence from Jesus' foes, Pilate proceeds to interrogate Jesus himself. And after his interview, he tries once more to release Jesus, but the Jewish leaders threaten him, saying, "If you release this man, you aren't a friend of the emperor. Anyone who makes himself out to be a king opposes the emperor." Now, in the middle of all of this, we have this sort of half-hearted attempt by Pilate to assert his authority. He scolds Jesus, "Don't you know that I have authority to release you and also to crucify you?" But John, interestingly, tells us that this statement is really based on Pilate's fear. I mean, it's really ironic. I mean, here we have Pilate, representative of the world's greatest power of the day, legions of troops at his command, vast wealth at his disposal. And we also have Jesus, a simple Galilean peasant who has no place to lay his head, who is facing capital charges against him. And Pilate is the one who's afraid. It seems that Pilate's afraid of many things. He's afraid of these Jewish leaders who have brought this man to him. He knows that one of his predecessors was removed from office after these very same leaders had complained. He's afraid of these large crowds that have gathered for Passover, worried that some other attempted revolt could always be possible. He's no doubt aware that it was at Passover some years earlier that a group of Samaritans had broken into the temple and defiled it by scattering human bones around. That had led to one of his predecessors' dismissal. Anything similar could happen to him. Pilate may have had the power of Rome behind him. He may command battalions of soldiers. He may be able to afford the finest goods in all of Judea, but he cannot free this man in his custody, whom he is convinced is innocent. Pilate is trapped by the very power that he claims to hold. He can't risk offending the crowds. He might lose his position. He can't stand up for what he really believes. It might cost him his comfort, his privilege. He can't really even understand what the Jewish authorities are so upset about, why they want Jesus executed. So it may appear that Jesus is on trial here, but in fact, the real defendant in this case is Pilate himself. Now, at the same time, the Jewish leaders also are quite fearful. I mean, they're threatened by this Galilean who tells stories and heals people. They're embarrassed by the popularity of this miracle worker who has stolen attention away from them. Their control of the temple and its treasury have been called into question because he overturned a few tables and let out a few beasts that were supposed to be sacrificed. But since they can't act against him on their own for fear of offending the crowds that follow him, they cajole Pilate to do their dirty work. And so doing, they are tried and ultimately convicted by their own words and actions. Because in the middle of all this, in order to ensure the execution of Jesus, the chief priests go far as to tell the governor this. They say, "We have no king except the emperor." No king except the emperor. That is a striking statement. It's especially striking because the chief priests are saying this on the very eve of Passover. Passover is a holiday which commemorates the liberation from another king, Pharaoh of Egypt, generations earlier. And in fact, the Passover liturgy that these very same priests are going to be leading has many times in which there's a repetition of these words, "Blessed are you, Lord our God, King of the universe." In his commentary in the book of John, my former advisor, Willard Swartley, notes that the Jewish leader's words to Pilate betray the fact that they value the preservation of their nation and law more highly then they value their covenant pledge to revere alone the Lord God's kingship. In these words, they indict themselves as apostate. The chief priests of all groups confess allegiance to the emperor, denying their covenant loyalty as people of God. One thing that becomes abundantly clear as one reads through this whole account of Jesus' arrest and crucifixion and execution in John's gospel is that Jesus is the one who's actually in charge this whole time. It's not the soldiers who arrest him. It's not Caiaphas, the high priest. It's not even Pilate. It is Jesus who's in charge. And while that crown of thrones and purple robe are meant as a mockery of Jesus' claim to kingship, they are in fact an unwitting affirmation of his out-of-this-world kingdom. In our text for today, Jesus has almost nothing to say. But his silence here really demonstrates his power in this case. By refusing to take the bait when he's questioned, Jesus is forcing Pilate to consider who's really in control here. Is the governor with the imperial power of Rome behind him really in charge? Or is it the Jewish leaders who are manipulating him and taking advantage of the volatility of the Passover crowds? Or are there even greater powers at play here that Pilate refuses to recognize? The only words that Jesus speaks in this entire section, he tells Pilate, "You would have no authority over me if it had not been given to you from above." Now, Pilate might think he's talking about Caesar here as the one from above, but of course, Jesus has in mind a much higher power than Caesar. Ultimately, Jesus is the one with real power in this confrontation. He has authority precisely because he has nothing to lose. He has no earthly power to protect, no material wealth to worry about, no social image to uphold. He can be who he really is, who God has called him, who God has destined him to be, precisely because all of those things don't matter to him. But Pilate is tightly bound by all of these forces. He has to save face. He has to hold fast to what he's got. He has to maintain that delicate balance of power between the Jewish religious leaders and the occupying Roman forces whom he represents. And if an innocent man has to die for all of that to happen, well, that's just too bad. As our text for today draws to a close, it seems that the Roman governor and the Jewish leaders have all managed to come out on top. They get what they want. Pilate hands Jesus over to be crucified. Turning again to Willard Swartley, he writes, "Pilate averts the threat of the uproar on his watch in his city. The Jews succeed in securing the sentence they want. However, the cost is high for both. Pilate has allowed himself and his authority among the Jews to be mocked and manipulated. The Jews have revoked the one characteristic identifying them as God's chosen people and nation. But what is empty victory for Pilate and the Jews is glorification for Jesus." And the uncomfortable truth that we face as we engage in this text is that we are not all that different from Pilate. We are not so different from those Jewish leaders calling for Jesus' blood because we also like to think that we are in charge. We like to think that we have the power, that we are self-sufficient, that we are able to act on our own. But every once in a while, something comes along, or someone comes along and reminds us that we are most definitely not in control here. And we can eat all the right food, and we can keep ourselves in top physical condition, we can follow all of our doctor's advice, but then we receive a devastating diagnosis or a massive pandemic hits. And we remember that we are not ultimately in control. We implement strict building codes. We make plans for every possible hazard, but when an earthquake strikes or tornado tears through town, we are reminded that we are ultimately not in control. We can invest ourselves in relationships, commit ourselves to loving others deeply, but when a loved one betrays our trust or a friend turns against us, we remember that we are not ultimately in control. In spite of living in this nation with the most powerful military in the history of the world, in spite of all the money that we might accumulate, in spite of all of our technology and our know-how and our accomplishments, there are limits. There are times we need to recognize that we just can't do it ourselves. In the end, what matters is not the power that we yield. What really matters is which power we choose to submit ourselves to. Do we bow to the pressures to save face, or do we yield instead to God, the creator of heaven and earth? Do we succumb to forces inviting us to keep pursuing more wealth, more material goods, or do we defer instead to Jesus, whose kingdom is out of this world? Do we give in to the desire for comfort and security, or do we subjugate ourselves to the one who came into the world to testify to the truth, the one who loves the world, seeking to redeem it, the one whose kingdom and power and glory are forever? Like Pilate, we may find this struggle to follow our conscience overwhelming at times. And like him, we will no doubt sometimes lose that struggle. But we are assured that when we do, Jesus is still there. And Jesus offers us truth and hope and peace, because he's the one who's really in charge. The daily headlines are indeed full of constant reminders that leaders of this world will disappoint us as they seek to preserve their power. Princes and politicians continue to engage in misconduct and corruption. Faith leaders also too often are motivated by attempts to maintain their own authority, their own institutions, even iconic figures like Cesar Chavez, who championed nonviolence and civil rights, whose Christian faith led him to work for the rights of the poor. Even he is revealed to be a deeply flawed figure, one who perpetrated great harm. And reminded that our faith, our trust, our hope ultimately lie in God alone, in the God whose power is most clearly revealed through his suffering servant, Jesus. And so we gather here in Jesus' name. We submit ourselves to his reign. We proclaim our dependence on his provision. We seek his support, his guidance. We humbly bow and we admit that he's the one who's really in charge.